Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. Between August 1976 and March 1977, several young women would lose their lives on the whim of a serial rapist and murderer. This is the bonus episode covering the crimes of Monty Rissell. Okay. On to the show. The beginning of Monty Rissell's life will shock no one familiar with his crimes. Monty was born in Virginia in 1959, the youngest of three children. When he was 7 years old, his parents divorced. Monty's mother took him and his two older siblings to California, leaving Monty's father behind. Monty would never see his father again, despite Monty's pleas to live with his father full-time. After his arrest, he was quoted as saying that if he lived with his father, he would have become a lawyer. Monty's mother remarried. She spent a lot of time with her new husband, leaving her children home alone. Monty's stepfather was ex-military and a strict disciplinarian. When Monty was 9, he began to show signs of an antisocial personality by writing obscene graffiti on the walls of his school. He also shot his cousin with an air rifle. When his stepfather found out, he beat Monty so hard with the air rifle that the gun broke. Monty, who was small for his age, suffered from his stepfather's beatings. When he was 12, Monty's mother and stepfather divorced. Monty's mother moved the children back to Virginia. With their split came relief from the beatings. However, Monty took the opportunity to amp up his bad behavior. The following year, he was arrested for driving without a license. The year after that, when Monty was 14, he was arrested for stealing a car, as well as the rape and robbery of his neighbor. He attacked his neighbor at knife point while wearing a mask. After this arrest, Monty was sent to reform school. There, he was diagnosed with multiple personality disorder, today known as dissociative identity disorder, as well as adjustment reaction of adolescence. Monty would continue to be in and out of institutions and receiving treatment until his final arrest. While in therapy, Monty had convinced his doctors that he was well on his way to perfect mental health, while he was also raping and killing local women. What ultimately drove Monty from rape and theft to murder was a girl. At the age of 18, still in high school, and receiving treatment from a psychiatrist, Monty received a letter from his girlfriend. She was a year older than him and attending college. In the Dear John letter, she told Monty that their relationship was over. Monty was shocked by the news, and he drove to her college campus to find out why she was leaving him. When he got there, he saw his girlfriend with another man, one she's clearly infatuated with. Monty saw them holding hands and kissing. After that, he only saw red. Monty didn't take his anger out on his ex-girlfriend. Instead, he got in his car and drove to a nearby liquor store to purchase alcohol, cigarettes, and found someone to sell him marijuana. He returned to his car and drove towards his apartment in Alexandria. He wanted to numb his anger, so he pulled into the parking lot of his apartment and sat in his car. Over the next several hours, he continued to drink and get high. It was now approaching 2 a.m. on August 4th, 1976. Monty was sufficiently drunk and high, but noticed his anger had not subsided as he had hoped. A car pulled up near his, and he squinted to see an attractive woman parking her 1976 Ford Mustang II. He made a rash decision, popped open his glove box, and removed a small handgun and knife from the compartment. He quickly exited his vehicle and approached hers. She was locking her door when she felt a dull poke in her back. Monty told her, "This is a stick-up." She caught her breath and pled, "Please don't hurt me." He responded, "I want your money. Now get back in the car." The young lady unlocked the door and entered the vehicle. He entered the passenger side of 26-year-old sex worker Ara Marina Gabor's car. He pressed the gun that was hidden in his coat pocket against her torso and ordered her to start driving. She could smell the alcohol on his breath. The stench of the marijuana he was smoking had permeated through the car. She didn't try to make small talk. She just wanted to follow his direction. He directed her to drive off the I-95 interstate into a secluded area. She did as directed and asked what he wanted. He told her that he wouldn't hurt her if she agreed to have sex with him. She's frightened, but relieved in a way. She knew how to have sex with strangers. She hiked up the skirt she was wearing and asked him how he liked it and what position he would like her in. He didn't appreciate the way she asked what he wanted and how he wanted her. He would later tell investigators in his confession, "It was like this bitch was trying to control things." He began to rape her aggressively, noticing that she faked 2 orgasms. Ara knew how to fake it and be convincing, but Monty was certain she was just a, quote, whore. He finished the act and pulled up his pants. He wasn't sure what he was going to do next. Ara didn't give him much time to plan his next move. She began to run from Monty and found herself down a ravine. Monty was fed up. Not only was she trying to control how they had sex, but now she was trying to control the ending. He caught up to her and put her in an arm lock. She tried to escape his grip, but he started choking her. This caused her to stumble and fall. Monty and Ara began rolling down the ravine. When Ara stopped, she hit her head on a rock. Monty grabbed her head and continuously banged it against the rock. Ara is slipping in and out of consciousness. He wrapped her bra around her neck tightly and pulled. She had no way of stopping what will happen next. Monty drug her down into the creek and held her head down. She was unable to keep fighting and soon she's dead. A rush of relief came over Monty and he thought to himself, "I could do this again." He made his way up the ravine and back to the car. He drove Ara's car back towards his apartment and abandoned it, walking the rest of the way. Her body was found a few days later, face down in the ravine, her bra still tightly fastened around her neck. Her car was later found, and detectives determined that she was likely accosted in the apartment parking lot. They had no leads, no serious suspects. Monty went back to his apartment and sat on his couch. He closed his eyes and replayed the last moments of Ara's life. He almost couldn't believe he got away with it. In some twisted way, Monty thought by committing this murder that he was getting back at his ex-girlfriend. And not just her, but all the women in the world that he hated so much. He wanted to stay under the radar as long as possible and went about his normal routine. 7 months after the death of Ara, he kidnapped 22-year-old Ursula Miltenberger. Ursula was a tall and vivacious woman, standing at 5'9". She was working full-time as a bill collector and was excited to quit that job to begin her management training at McDonald's. She was a graduate of Shepherd's College in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, where she received her bachelor's in computer science. She had an opportunity to work on her family's dairy farm, but opted to head to the big city and make a name for herself. On March 6, 1977, at around 2 o'clock a.m., she left the McDonald's restaurant she was training at and told a co-worker that she was headed to a party. Monty approached her the same way he did Ara and forced her back into her car and told her to drive. During the car ride, Ursula was annoying Monty with her questions. She kept asking him, what was he going to do? Why did he pick her? Did he have a girlfriend? And what was his problem? She parked the car as directed, but decided to make a run for it. Monty grabbed his knife and chased after her. He tackled her to the ground and began stabbing her in the chest. He struck her in the head with a blunt object and bound her hands and feet. He was so angry that he hadn't gotten the chance to finish what he intended to do that he straddled her torso and continued stabbing her multiple times. Bloody and out of breath, he watched her die. When he was sure she was gone, he left. Monty abandoned her car near his apartment and walked the rest of the way home to clean himself up. The area he lived in was riddled with petty criminals, so it was likely that if anyone did see him bloodied and disheveled, that they ignored his presence and moved on. He entered his apartment, took a shower, fixed himself something to eat, and went to sleep. He lived with his mother, who either was unaware or didn't care what Monty was up to when he slipped out late at night. He slept through the breaking news that flashed across the television screen. At around 10 o'clock a.m. on March 6th, a horseback rider found the bloodied and bruised body of Ursula Miltenberger. The rider immediately returned to her home to call the police. The police, again, had no suspects and no leads to go on. When they questioned Ursula's co-workers at the McDonald's restaurant, they indicated that she left the restaurant alone but was going to a party. None of the partygoers recalled Ursula making it to the party. Detectives notified her family, and they indicated that she had no enemies. It seemed as if her attack and murder was completely random. When Monty woke up, he heard that Ursula's body had been found. Instead of being nervous about being caught, he was energized and motivated to continue his killing spree. He enjoyed and reveled in the power that came with overpowering the frightened women he encountered. It was a rush of excitement, adrenaline, and rage. He wanted to be on the prowl again, but he knew he had to wait. In April, he was ready to strike again. He kept the same M.O. and targeted a woman near his home. Her identity remains a mystery. Monty said he kidnapped her in the same manner as Ara, made her drive to a secluded wooded area, and forced her to disrobe. He raped her and was ready to kill again, but she begged for her life. Normally, these pleas would fall on deaf ears, but this time, they didn't. The young woman said she was a sole caretaker for her grandfather, who was ill with cancer. She begged for him to please let her go. He surprisingly felt her pain. His brother was also suffering with the disease, and he agreed to release her. He told her that he knew where she lived and would kill her and her grandfather if she went to authorities. She promised she wouldn't, and kept her word. Jeanette McClellan, age 24, a proofreader for a printing firm, was arriving to the Holmes Run apartment complex where she lived. Holmes Run was near where Monty lived. She entered the elevator, but was surprised to see a man with a large kitchen knife pointed towards her. He made her exit the elevator with the knife pressed against her back. Like the others, Monty forced her into the car, and they drove to a secluded area. He promised her that he wouldn't hurt her if she agreed to have sex with him. Through her tears, she agreed, believing his lies. He raped her twice and asked her to drive to a dead-end street. She was still processing the violation of her body when Monty forced her out of the car. He walked behind her, telling her to keep her eyes ahead and not to look at him. She's shaking but continued walking. They get close to a culvert that is near the apartment complex. She just wanted to go home. He made her stop walking and told her to turn around. She complied and immediately felt a sharp pain in her chest. She looked down and realized she had been stabbed. She screamed and fell to the ground, blood gushing from her wound. He turned her over and began stabbing her in the back. Blood was now coming from her mouth, and she couldn't breathe. He grabbed her by the hair and dragged her across the culvert and continued stabbing her. He stabbed her a total of 24 times. He stared at her as she died and then covered her body with wood debris and rocks. He tucked the knife away in his jean waistband and walked home. Her badly decomposed body would not be discovered until May 5, 1977. He showered and went to bed. When he woke, he washed the knife and placed it back in the kitchen drawer. By now, Monty's killer instinct has kicked into overdrive. He committed his next two murders in very quick succession. A few weeks after accosting Jeanette, he did the same to 27-year-old Gladys Bradley. She was a distribution clerk in a Washington, D.C. post office who resided in the same complex as Jeanette, Holmes Run. She arrived home after picking up extra hours at the post office. She was tired and looking forward to relaxing for the rest of the evening. Monty by now had complete control of the situation. He had been watching for his next victim. He spotted her and Gladys and followed her into the elevator. He approached her with a knife in the same fashion, and they got in the car. He ordered her to drive near the same secluded area that he took Jeanette. He again promised his victim that no harm will come to her if she agreed to have sex. He forced her out of the car and raped her on the ground. He again told her to dress and forced her to walk further toward the creek. He stabbed her in the back and she fell to the ground. He dragged her into the creek and put her end face down. He sat on her back and continued stabbing her. She gasped for air, but she won't survive this. She stopped flailing, but Monty continued sitting on her back, just taking in the moment. He collected the knife and walked back home. Detectives found Gladys's body on April 30th, 1977.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
After finding the body stabbed in the same fashion as the other victims, authorities connected the dots and realized they had a serial murderer on their hands. Women in the landmark neighborhood were frightened to leave their homes without an escort. Monty was well known in his neighborhood and often escorted women back and forth from their homes. He likely did this because he got some thrill out of knowing that he could take their lives if he wanted to. On April 8, 1977, Monty had the steak knife in his jean waistband, just sitting on a knoll between his apartment complex and the Holmes Run apartments, looking for his next victim. 35-year-old Aletha Byrd was abducted from the apartment. She drove to Lake Barcroft near Fairfax, Virginia. He raped her twice and told her to drive further up the road. Aletha saw this as a time for negotiation, and she told Monty that if he did not throw the knife he had out of the window, that she would crash into the tree. She pressed on the gas and began accelerating towards a tree. Monty put his foot on the brakes and the car came to an immediate stop. Aletha jumped out of the car and ran towards a barbed wire fence. Monty chased after her and she fought him off. She tried hard to flee, but Monty was able to quickly stab her in the chest to subdue her. She was stabbed a total of 14 times. He looked for a heavy log to conceal her body. On April 20th, 1977, Monty, who had been a poor student, withdrew from T.C. Williams High School. He now had plenty of time to spend on stalking and murdering women. What Monty didn't know was that police had requested a personality profile on the potential murderer. When Detective John W. Turner reviewed the profile, the first person he thought of was Monty Ralph Rissell. Monty was the young kid he had arrested for attempting to rob a woman in his apartment complex. He had known Monty and his mother very well. He had no solid evidence to say it was Monty, but he always kept it in the back of his mind. When Detective Turner arrived to the Bradley crime scene, he realized that her car had been found near where Ara Gabor's car had been discovered. The vehicles and bodies were extremely close to the apartment complex that Monty lived in with his mother. As May approached, the profile suggested that the deadly conduct would only escalate since the killer had not been apprehended by authorities. With this in mind, Detective Turner ordered that officers stake out the creek beds and set up roadblocks to see if they could capture the elusive killer. I have to believe that Monty knew about the strong police presence in his neighborhood and made every effort to control his urges. He grew sloppy with Aletha's murder. From the crime scene, he took her wallet, keys, and comb. On May 17, 1977, after several failed stakeouts, Monty was arrested on unrelated charges tied to an assault on two teenagers in the complex. Detective Turner had his opportunity to question Monty about the string of murders in the area. In a surprising twist, Monty admitted to murdering the five women. He was booked on felony charges of abducting, raping, and murdering all of the women. When his car was searched, they found the wallet, keys, and comb belonging to Aletha Byrd. Monty was requested to draw a map of the locations of the remaining bodies and crime scenes. He did so under the pretense that authorities would advocate for him to receive psychiatric help in prison. He had a relatively positive disposition in the previous hearings regarding his crimes. He would look around the courtroom, smiling and writing notes. In September, his cheery disposition turned more somber as he was scheduled to plead guilty on the record. His guilty plea meant that prosecutors dropped the four charges of rape and abduction. His mother was in the courtroom, seated on the front row at every other hearing, but she was not present for this plea. On October 11, 1977, the Fairfax County Courthouse was filled with his mother, sister, and friends from high school. Judge Donald H. Kent asked Monty if he prepared a statement to read to the court. His defense attorney stood up and informed the judge that Monty wanted to only express that he was remorseful for his actions, and then sat back down. Judge Kent handed down a sentence of 4 life terms with the opportunity for parole after 20 years. The sentence would be served at the Southampton Correctional Farm. Monty's mother and sister silently shed tears as they heard the sentencing. Monty's time behind bars were relatively quiet. He did attempt to pen a tell-all book detailing his crimes. He claimed the money he would make from the book would go to the victims' families, and of course, to him and his family. Thankfully, the 461-page manuscript he titled The Trials and Tribulations of Monty R. Rissell would never see publication. Virginia delegate George Grayson introduced a bill to the Virginia legislature that would prevent criminals from profiting off their crimes. If any such publication did occur, the funds would be dispersed to the victims' families. After Monty had served 20 years, the victims' families were notified in July of 1995 that his parole hearing was scheduled in September. Robert McClelland, the father of Jeanette McClelland, told reporters, quote, "But you don't think, if you can help it, truthfully, about the death? It brings all that back and brings all those nerves tender again. Those are the moments you don't care to remember, and you wouldn't if you could." Jeanette's younger sister Susan followed up her father's comments by saying, quote, "We cannot fix him, but we can help him by not allowing him to do this to other people. But for us, this is the last thing we can do for Jeanette. We don't really mind it in that perspective." Monty was denied parole and remains incarcerated. His crimes have been featured on the Netflix original series, Mindhunter, and was the inspiration for this episode. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. Music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check him out on Twitter at WeTalkOfDreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Research assistance, content editing, and writing assistance for the show was provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering was provided by Chez Gray, who manages Chez Gray Music. Content warning at the top of the show was provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast. We would like to welcome to the club our most recent Patreon supporters, Nancy P., Scott Q., and Jin P.